Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Pittman. My name is Valerie Vandepan, and this is Welcome to Florida. I am sitting in for Chad Scott today. I was an environmental journalist at WGCU in Southwest Florida, and I also have a family, multiple generations of family in Florida, including my great-great-grandfather, who was the consummate Florida man.
Welcome, Valerie. We're glad you're able to fill in for Chad.
Thanks for having me, Craig. Sure. I'm glad to be here. And I'm also super excited to talk about your latest piece in Flamingo magazine, which is actually in print on newsstands now. So if y'all are listening, you can't find it on the internet, you got to go to Publix or another newsstand and buy it on the stand.
Yeah. I wrote about, if you're not familiar with Flamingo, it's the only statewide culture and history and lifestyle magazine in Florida. And the editor asked me to write something related to the environment. There are a million possibilities there. But I wound up writing about this new documentary series called Protect Our Paradise that the folks from Conservation Florida put out in collaboration with a guy named Chad Crawford, who does a TV series called How to Do Florida, where he roams around and does lots of adventurous stuff around the state. And he told me that he, as he was doing these stories, you know, about, diving in the springs and things like that, that he just kept running across environmental problems that were getting worse and worse and worse. And it really sort of burdened his soul, you might say. And so he decided to do this new series. I think there are 8 episodes where he looks at some of the environmental problems that are plaguing us in Florida, toxic algae blooms, water pollution, and so forth, and people who are working to solve them, people who are pitching in or coming up with ways to try and deal with things. Some of the people who were on it were interesting, and one of them has actually been a guest on our show, Clay Henderson, who wrote this great book called Forces of Nature, which is a history of environmental conservation efforts in Florida. And it was just a really interesting subject, and the idea of how they tackled it in this TV show I thought was fascinating.
Well, your story was really inspiring, and I'm looking forward to actually physically watching it. What burned my soul, though, was that there seems to be a void of actually looking at some of the money behind what's going on in Florida right now.
Yeah. And I mean, the people making the series made a conscious decision to avoid politics, which meant they didn't identify the people who are causing the problems and say, these are the people you need to focus on, or point to the politicians who have been ignoring things. And instead they just went with, here are the problems and here are people working on solving it, which I understand the choice, but I also think that lets some people get off the hook a little too easily. But that's just me. That's just my opinion.
I kind of feel that too, because often, in my experience anyway, in covering the environment or these kinds of issues, there really are some very identifiable people and businesses that are at the core of what's happening, or laws and lawmakers. It's not like it's like some nebulous group that nobody knows. Mm-hmm. We think it's a nebulous group that nobody knows when we don't actually say and discuss who's really behind what's happening.
Yeah, this is not some QAnon conspiracy theory. This is, you know, these are the people making the major campaign contributions. These are their benefits they're getting as a result of it. And they're doing this stuff and screwing up Florida, and they figure they won't have to worry about the consequences because they'll have already made their profits and moved on. But it's a fascinating series. The great visuals. I just can't say enough about how beautiful the shots are and everything like that. And some interesting people who were interviewed. One of them is Tessa Skiles, who's the daughter of Wes Skiles, the famous explorer. We actually had Julie Hauserman on the show to talk about Wes Skiles. And so I would encourage you to watch it, but just remember also that there's an element that's missing too. So just bear that in mind.
And since y'all are listening to Craig already, you probably know who those folks are. So keep listening, keep reading Craig, and you'll get even more information. Welcome to Florida is presented by WindstormProducts.com, the world's largest online distributor of hurricane hardware. What is hurricane hardware? Those are the bolts and anchors and wing nuts and tools you need to secure your home or office against hurricane wind damage. Whether your structure or outdoor area is brick, concrete, stucco, or wood, the experts at Hurricane Hardware will match your property with the right hardware to make sure your outdoor furniture and shutters aren't flying all over the neighborhood during hurricane winds. Visit windstormproducts.com to learn more and feel free to give them a call to discuss your specific concerns. Toll-free number right on their website. Today, we are talking with William McKean about Jimmy Buffett and Key West. McKean is the author of Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West.
I've known him for quite a while. He actually edited put together and edited a book that I contributed to called Homegrown in Florida, where people who grew up here tell stories about what it was like growing up here. And I was one of the contributors. Jeff Klinkenberg, a colleague of mine at the Tampa Bay Times, contributed. Tom Petty talks about growing up here. Michael Connelly, the famous mystery writer who grew up in Fort Lauderdale, talks about one time when the cops took him in for questioning. And it's just it's a fascinating book. But this book, Mile Marker Zero, talks about this really magical time in Key West in the 70s when everybody who was anybody as far as the arts and writing and so forth was living there. And then Jimmy Buffett showed up. And with the recent death of Jimmy Buffett, I figured he'd be the perfect person to talk about how Buffett landed in Key West and what he learned from living there and how it changed his life and how he wound up changing the Keys. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're talking about one particular aspect of one of my favorite books by you, Mile Marker Zero, which is sort of a cultural history of Key West. And I specifically wanted to talk to you. Everyone was shattered when Jimmy Buffett died recently, but you've sort of got the inside story of how Jimmy Buffett wound up in Key West, that he wasn't from there. He had no real background for being there. And yet he wound up sort of adopting Key West as his hometown and changing the place as well as changing everyone's perception of it. How did he wind up there? Maybe is the way to start.
Well, that's a good story. He was born in Pascagoula and had ended up finally finishing school at the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg as a journalism major, of all things.
No money in that.
He picked up guitar kind of late in life. I forget his age, but I think he was about college age when he picked it up, and he decided he wanted to be a performer. And of course, immediately he was categorized as another long-haired country singer, but that really wasn't his, I don't think that was his, what would the kids today say? That wasn't his jam. He liked, he liked a whole bunch of different music. He liked the kind of the gumbo he got from New Orleans because, you know, you're not far away when you're in Pascagoula. So he liked a lot of R&B and he liked, that crazy indigenous music of New Orleans. And he liked rock and roll. He liked lots of things. But when he went to Nashville, he initially was a reporter for Billboard magazine. In fact, I think one of his big scoops was breaking the story that the Doobie Brothers were breaking up. I think that's the big story.
Yeah.
But anyway, when he began to get into the music business there, he, again, was typecast as the long-haired, new shit-kicker country boys like there were so many at that time. And I think he really found himself, as he said in one of his songs, "I have found me a home." I think he found himself when he went to Key West. It wasn't just that he was adopting a persona or a shtick or anything like that. I think it was just that the diverse community that is Key West, I think, kind of awakened all those diverse aspects in his soul, because he was a really complicated guy. He's extremely well read. He was a good writer of prose. Obviously, he was a great musician, entertainer. He could do just about anything. And I think that, he didn't want to just be the latest country boy, the latest country and Western singer, anything like that. So I think we could say he's responsible almost for a whole genre now. There are a lot of trop rock artists out there. I hate that abbreviation, but you know, it'll have to do.
He was flat broke when he first showed up down there, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he was. He had met Jerry Jeff Walker, who I love this story. Jerry Jeff Walker sounds like the quintessential country and western singer, and his original name was Ronald Clyde Crosby.
Oh my God!
So he picked up that performing name, and he had had a hit, a modest hit of his own with Mr. Bojangles, and it became a hit for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And a music industry guy that was involved with both Ronald Clyde Crosby and Jimmy Buffett introduced them. And so they became friends. And Jerry Jeff Walker was at that point living in Coconut Grove. And he said to Jimmy Buffett, anytime you come down, let me know. It'll put you up. So he did. And Buffett went down there to for a gig at a club called The Flick in Coconut Grove, which was kind of the preeminent folky bar down there. I guess Joni Mitchell had played there and some other Eric Anderson artists like that. Now, obviously, Jerry Jeff Walker had. So Buffett got down there. He had made the connection with Jerry Jeff Walker about a place to stay. And then he found out, oops, the manager screwed up. The owner of The Flick, I guess, had scheduled it. In his mind, he had not scheduled him at the right time. Buffett was sure he was the one that had the dates right. And the manager said, no, you come back in 2 weeks.
Oh, man.
So with 2 weeks to kill, he ended up going back to Jerry Jeff's. And Jerry Jeff was living with his girlfriend, just not knowing what to do. The girlfriend, whose name is Murphy, just says, well, hell, let's go to Key West. And they drank their way down US 1. Don't try this at home.
Yeah.
And they went to the No Name Bar. They stopped in Isla Mirada. They went to all the usual places. And then they ended up in Key West. And he, you know, just sort of fell in love with the place, I think.
When did he meet Tom Corcoran?
He met him the first night when he came into the chart room, which is the bar at the Pier House. Jerry Jeff was introducing him around to everybody. They were all excited to see Jerry Jeff. They hadn't expected him. So he was showing him around and he led him over to the bar and he said, Tom, this is Jimmy Buffett. And it's his first night in town. And Tom gave him a beer and said, first one's free. And so that was the beginning of their relationship. And they ended up writing a couple of songs together over the years. And Tom helped out in a number of ways. He once took Jimmy's sloop from point A to point A prime with James Taylor aboard. And then Jimmy Buffett was meeting up with him on point A prime. So, you know, he was just a guy in the circle for a long time. And it's kind of sad that both of them died this year.
Yeah. Just well, and Corcoran's photos wound up on the cover of like, what, 9 Jimmy Buffett albums?
Yeah, he took the pictures for a lot of them and for years would publish even more in the Jimmy Buffett calendar, which, you know, he produced in his living room and he had boxes and boxes of them around. So he was you know, he had actually put Buffett up for a while on his couch before Jimmy had his own place. And then when Jimmy was up north, he had decided he was going to allow the insane journalist Hunter S. Thompson use his apartment in Key West. And when he did, he called Tom Corcoran and said, would you take care of him? And that turned out to be kind of scary. But then
yeah,
Tom and Hunter Thompson ended up collaborating on a couple of things, too.
At what point did Jimmy decide to move down there?
You know, I don't know exactly when, but I think fairly soon he saw that this is the kind of community he had been looking for. I mean, it was in that period in the 1970s, there were a number of really excellent artists in practice there. Tennessee Williams lived there. In fact, he lived across the alley from my ex-uncle-in-law. is the first human being you see in the film version of Tennessee Williams' Rose Tattoo. Now, there's
a claim to fame.
There's a claim to fame. And they made him, the movie company made him wear his own shirt, and they never gave it back to him. And he's, you know, 80 years old now. He's still pissed off. But anyway, it was just a different kind of town. I mean, this is when the whole gang known as the Sporting Club that Thomas McGuane and the painter Russell Chatham and the writer and poet Jim Harrison were all there. And fairly soon they fell into the same circles. Of course, McGuane and Buffett were eventually related by marriage, not to each other, but marriage for about 30 or 40 years. And, you know, it was just a very creative atmosphere. And for example, the reason I think Hunter Thompson liked Key West was that he was a reporter and he had covered the presidential campaign in 1972, but by 1976, he was too famous to be a reporter because he was recognized everywhere. So he went to Key West and it wasn't that people didn't recognize him. It's just they just didn't care. And I think that's that laissez-faire attitude is a very appealing thing about Key West. And I'm sure it was to Jimmy Buffett. I always like to call him Jimmy Buffet because I think it's one of the most common typos in American journalism. People still don't know how to spell his name correctly.
Well, when he got the first Save the Manatee license plate, they misspelled his name that way.
Oh, I didn't know that. I think he got there and just, as the song said, I found me a home. And I think that it was a good home for a while. And then when the family begins to kick in, I think he and his wife decided they needed to be someplace a little bit more stable. I've known a lot of people from Key West over the years, and sometimes they speak of getting out of Key West. And you, if you're a clueless outsider, you might say, well, why would you want to get out of there? Isn't it perfect? And it's perfect for a lot of things, but it's not exactly perfect for raising a family all the time. And there was a, you know, obviously in the 70s, there was so much dope there. I'm sorry, the young folks call it weed. My generation call it dope.
Strictly for medicinal purposes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's all legal now, which is funny. Funny that people still, you know, are still doing time for a joint from, you know, 40 years ago. But anyway, and so I think that they moved away in order to find a place where they could raise a family. And I think he had already done just about everything he could do in Key West. I think he had absorbed the energy of the place. And, you know, and I don't mean this in a commercial sense at all, but he'd kind of bottled it. He knew what he wanted and knew the stories that he wanted to tell. He knew of what he was capable. You know, I think he was just ready to move on. He was, I think, probably too restless to stay in one place all the time. And I think the public at large, after Margaritaville broke, I think everyone sort of expected to drive down US 1. And as soon as they hit the city limits, you pull over and there's a stand and Jimmy's there handing out margaritas. You know? It wasn't that way. But I think that's what, you know, I think that's the feeling people had.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you, how were he and McGuane related?
Jimmy's sister married Tom McGuane.
Oh, okay.
His sister, Lori. And the story with Tom McGuane is that, you know, he's his family's from Michigan. He had roots here in fact, down the road, I think, in Fall River, Massachusetts. He went to Key West, I think, the first time with his father fishing. And then when he made his first money off of his writing in the late 60s and early 70s. He made the money not by selling books, but by selling the books to the movies. He ended up going to Key West and kind of falling in love with the place and kind of went crazy too, in the sense that I think he was married within the space of 18 months. I think he was involved in three marriages and one extramarital affair. How would you have time? That's what I want to know.
Well, yeah, it really cuts into your fishing.
Yeah, I know. He went down there. He'd been married for many years, I think almost 20 years, to a woman named Rebecca, who was a direct descendant of David Crockett. And then while there, they were making a movie of Tom McGuane's book, 92 in the Shade. And it being the 70s, the movie studio just said to McGuane, "You've never directed a movie before. Here's $1 million. Go do it." So he did. And his wife ended up going off with Peter Fonda, who was the star of the movie. And they got married and were together 30 years. And then Tom fell in love, was already in love with Elizabeth Ashley, who was going to have a part in the movie. But he fell in love with the leading woman on the film, who was Margot Kidder. They were married very briefly. And then after that, he married Jimmy's sister, and they stayed married from, I guess, about 1978 until, well, they're still married.
Wow.
They're still married. So, and he went through a lifestyle change. He had been kind of a party boy, and he gave it all up. And he's been clean and sober since around that time, at least 40 years. Also, I think that people have this, people who don't investigate Jimmy Buffett that much probably had the feeling, oh, well, he must be a drunk, or he's, you know, he's always talking about Margaritaville and drinking and things like that. And I think that was just a carefully cultivated persona. And it was a good persona to have, to be a, you know, the party boy. But he was, I think, too intelligent to have serious problems with any drugs or alcohol. And he used his time on earth pretty wisely.
Forgive me, because Jimmy Buffett was a little bit before my time. I'm curious about Margaritaville. Because you said after the hit came out, people, you know, went to Key West and expected to see him there. And I kind of feel like that's kind of when I became conscious of what he was. Was that when the party was over in Key West? Did Margarita become a huge hit and then all these Jimmy Buffett fans started flooding there and then everyone was kind of like, maybe the party's over? Was that the end of the road, so to speak, of that party in the 70s?
I think that gang, the sporting club, which, you know, then took Jimmy Buffett under its wing, the McGuane, Harrison, Guy Duvaldin, Jim Harrison crowd, that they were leaving by then. I think the Mario Boatlift in 1980, I think that was also kind of a changing scene, because suddenly the sleepy little town became overrun with people. It just became way too popular. And I think maybe Buffett was responsible for that, for the frat brothers coming down on spring break, you know, before they might have stopped at Fort Lauderdale or someplace else, or Panama City. But now they were going all the way to Key West. And I think that I think he and it played a role in popularizing it. But there were so many other things that were changing about Key West in that time. And I think because it was a safe place, I think a lot of people who were not necessarily at home or welcomed elsewhere had a lot of capital. They came down to Key West and began fixing it up and, you know, gentrifying it to some extent, got to the point where the people who actually lived in Key West could no longer live in Key West because it became so expensive. It's just kind of sad. You know, now, you know, there's no sweet little original conch house on this street, but there is a replica of one. You know, we tore down the original and we put a replica in its place. I think that's kind of what's happened to a lot of it.
He, I think, helped that along a little bit, didn't he, by setting up his first Jimmy Buffett store there, right, where you could buy authentic Jimmy Buffett souvenirs, T-shirts and so forth.
He kind of did that as a favor to a friend, and I don't have the book in front of me, but I believe her name was Sunshine.
Yes.
She said something about making, you know, all these people are ripping you off. They're making these T-shirts and selling them at concerts, why don't you do that? And he says, well, let's do it. And sort of put her in charge. And Margaritaville grew from that. I heard him say once that he didn't really make very much money until Margaritaville was bought out by the folks that own Outback Steakhouse. And then he became a shareholder. Then he started making money. I found that kind of, I'm sure he was exaggerating, but I can imagine today how musicians would have difficulty making money with streaming and all that being what it is. But his concerts surely must have always grossed pretty well. But nonetheless, I think that he was just a really smart businessman on top of everything else.
Yeah, he wound up with what, like $1 billion value on all his holdings?
Is it a billion? Okay.
I think the New York Times in his obituary talked about having that much money. When you listen to his music, what songs remind you of Key West? What songs do you think came out of that Key West experience? The Pirate Looks at 40 is the one that comes to my mind.
Mother, Mother Ocean, I have heard you call. Wanted to sail upon your waters since I was 3 feet tall. You've seen it all. You've seen it all.
I don't know what.
Yeah, and that one, interestingly enough, the woman that was with Jerry Jeff Walker was with, when she broke up with Jerry Jeff, she ended up with Phil Clark, who's the inspiration for that song, who I guess disappeared. The songs of Buffett's that I like speak to me of more than just Key West. My favorite album of his is called Flora Days, and it's about, it has some kind of elements of Gabriel Garcia Marquez in it. There's a song in there called No One Writes to the Captain No More. And I believe the book by Garcia Marquez is No One Writes to the Colonel Anymore, something like that. So, you know, he was obviously going for that reference, but the song itself, Flora Days, I always thought was beautiful. I like Come Monday. I think that's a beautiful song. That sort of predates the real Key Westian flavor of most of his work. But Woman Going Crazy on Caroline Street, Cuban Crime of Passion. Mm-hmm. I think those are the ones that I would tend to associate more with Key West, and Changes in Latitudes. I think there are lots of songs here and there that would have that. And he was a welcome collaborator, not just with Tom McGuane, but you know, he ended up writing songs with a lot of different people. And not that he needed to. He was a perfectly excellent songwriter on his own.
I'm curious again, because again, pardon my ignorance about Jimmy Buffett and Key West, but I have two questions. They may or may not be related. The first is the title of your book, Mile Marker Zero, The Movable Feast of Key West. I don't know why it's a movable feast.
It was sort of inspired by the movable feast that Hemingway wrote about, where there was just a gathering of really great minds and talents in Paris in the 1920s, Gertrude Stein and Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Ford Madox Ford. Or was it Ford Madox Chevrolet? I forget his name. the title is taken from is from Hemingway, that if you have ever lived through this, then you have had a movable feast or something like that. And so my feeling about putting this story together was that, well, this is the same kind of meeting of the minds. To borrow a phrase from the Parrot Heads, that's what they call their annual conference, the meeting of the minds. This meeting of it, there was just such a great bunch of talent there at one time. And, you know, it's something that I don't think could happen there again. Maybe it can happen somewhere else. But it was just a nice way of equating those two things half a century apart.
You also say it's you call it, I'm reading, I'll read it directly. Despite oceans of booze and boatloads of pot, through serial marriages and sexual escapades in that dangerous paradise. I'm curious, what was dangerous about Key West in the 70s?
The stuff in the earlier part of the sentence, all the drugs and the booze. I mean, my ex-wife is from Key West. And now and then we'd talk about moving down there. And she said, you know, you would never survive. you know, it's like you had to be growing up. You had to grow up there to build up that resistance, to have a stomach that's made of cast iron that, you know, can handle, you know, three of this kind of mixed drink and four of those, and then a couple of beers to chase it. You know, just I would be in terrible shape if I lived there. It's the kind of, I think Russell Chatham says somewhere in the book, it's the, this is a locale that suggests promiscuity. It's the kind of place where if it's a vice, you will excel at that vice. And if there isn't a vice, you will invent a new one. It was just the kind of, I think the you know, there's sort of a tie between the people that were wreckers on the keys, on the reefs offshore 200 years ago, the pirates, and the people who ended up selling dope there in the 70s. It really wasn't hidden. Back in those old illegal days, they kept it. I mean, people were selling it from the t-shirt shops, under the counter at bars. There were some public officials that we've never heard from again who were involved.
A little Bumfardo.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Buffett used to wear his Bumfardo t-shirt in concert. So it was the whole sordid history of the island. And I put sordid in quotes because, of course, most of that stuff's legal now. I mean, that was one of the reasons that I think people found Key West attractive in those days before it was a huge tourist attraction. I think artists and writers and filmmakers found it attractive because it was, you know, being a little bit of a pirate by proxy. I think they liked some of the unsavory things about the town.
Well, it was very laid back too, right? That
laid back to the point of comatose.
Yeah.
I think people, it really is live and let live. They just don't really care. They want to know what's going on, but they don't want to care. That's how it was described to me by a lifelong conk. Just, you know, we don't hide anything from us, but we don't really care. We're not going to bother you. you know, I haven't been there in a few years, and I really miss going there. It would be so weird to go there now, because the last few times I was there, I was with Tom Corcoran and also Dink Bruce. And I dedicated the book in part to Dink because he hosted me not only in Key West, but also in Montana, because most of the characters in Mile Marker Zero had moved to Montana. And to get away from Key West, as I said, it got to be too much. Dink died a few years ago, but his family had been, I guess his father was kind of Ernest Hemingway's right-hand man. So when Thomas McGuane came to Key West in the early 1970s and Time magazine had called him the next Hemingway, of course he went and got Toby Bruce's son to be his writer. So he was...
He never beat up a poet the way Hemingway did, though.
I first went there when I was about 9 years old and didn't go back much before I was a fully grown adult and a parent and all of that stuff. But even in that short time, in the last 20 years, it's gone through a really, really remarkable change.
Do you think they'll ever have another concentration like that again?
I don't know. That's a good question. Well, they'd have to have already been extremely successful to afford it. Mm-hmm. What we need to do is to discover some new mecca that could be a mecca for artists and writers and filmmakers, like Possum Trot, Alabama. Let's make that the new Key West. Or is there a place in Arkansas called Toad Crotch? There's a place out in the Oklahoma Panhandle called Slap Out. I mean, the possibilities are endless. Unfortunately, none of them are on the water, though.
Yeah.
I don't know when the last time was you were down there, Craig, but it's, you know, I'd be curious what you think. It just seems like it's the cost there is prohibitive. And That doesn't say anything about the parking. The parking is insane.
I'm actually going in January for the Key West Literary Seminar. They're the theme this year is the state we're in. And they've got Carl Hiaasen coming and I forget who else. And I'm getting to sneak in under the tent somehow. So
that's the title of your new book, isn't it? The state.
Yes. My last book was The State You're In. So
excellent. The first time I went to Key West was a little while ago, several years ago now. But, you know, I had this fantasy in my mind that it was going to be this really laid back, cool, chill place. And I drove down with a girlfriend of mine, and we couldn't afford any place to stay for one night. And we couldn't afford to eat anywhere or drink anywhere. Everything was just so cost prohibitive. I think we were both very, very ill prepared for what we found when we got there. So we ended up sleeping in our car in a parking lot, and the security guard kicked everybody else out of the parking lot but us, including someone who was very drunk and screaming, "I'm too drunk to drive. Just let me sleep it off. I'm too drunk. And the security guard still kicked him out, but mercifully let the two girls in the car sleep until just before dawn, first light. We got a knock on the window, you know, "Move along, girls." So we did. We moved the vehicle, and then we went and slept on the beach for the remainder of the morning, because it was made very clear to us sleeping on the beach was not an option. And we couldn't do that, which is why we chose the car in a parking lot. I remember feeling just so disappointed and so sad and so bummed that this place that's mythologically a cool place for chill people, that was so laid back supposedly, was so, you know, "Don't sleep on the beach. Don't sleep in the parking lot. You know, pay $500 a night for the cheapest hotel room in town." It was just really unreal and kind of disappointing. But I did go back. I took the ferry the next time from Fort Myers.
That was smart. The ferry is smart. Yeah.
and I also came with money, which is helpful.
They prefer it that way.
Yeah. And I had a very different time.
I think the town's kind of, the last time I was there, it seems like it was getting overbroed, if you know what I mean. Too many bros. Of course, I had married into a Key West family for about 15 years, so I always had a place to stay. I miss that. I don't know. There aren't any sweet little mom and pop motels anymore. It's, you know, the whole Keys has changed. I don't know, Craig, if we were talking about this at any time. I think I was having a rare conversation with Klinkenberg the other day, and I was talking about this place I used to love when I was a kid in the Upper Keys called Mac and Marie's. And I remember one night Ted Williams came to the door, and Mac wouldn't let him in because it was after 8 o'clock. And, you know, nobody got in after 8 o'clock, and, you know, Vice President Nixon would come there and all of that. It was just a place where a couple ran this restaurant, and the cook would put on the food and then come out and smoke a cigarette and jaw with the clients and then go back and, "Oh shit, I burned it. I got to start all over," that kind of place. And, you know, that the charming characters of the Keys are now probably out of work actors. A lot of that authenticity seems to be gone. But what do I? I'm in Massachusetts.
There you go. We'll send you some migrants.
Thank you so much for sharing with us today. That was really wonderful.
This was great. Yeah. Thanks again.
Nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake. All of those tourists covered with oil.
So you had no experience really with Buffett, is what you're saying? That's
no, you're too young. I was too young, and it was not really my jam. And then mm-hmm. Everyone just seemed so, I don't know, like drunk on beer, and which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Yeah. But like, you know, like I said, I had this fantasy about Key West, and it was very expensive, mm-hmm. and like he said, a lot of bros. and very jocky. And I think the jock vibe is probably one of the things that turned me off to Buffett when I kind of got to an age where maybe I should have liked him more. It was kind of that like penny loafer shorts and polo shirt crowd.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he came. See, I'm right in the right demographic. He came and played at my college back around, I think, the Cretaceous period, and hugely popular, even though he's kind of at the beginning of his career at that point. And the thing I remember most about the concert, though, is not his playing and singing or the excellent work by the Coral Reefer Band, his backup group, but the fact that one of my classmates, a very straight-laced young lady, really got into the concert and was singing along very loudly with a song that she thought was called "Why Don't We Get Drunk at School," which is not at all the real name of the song.
I do know that song.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with that song.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are familiar with that song. And so, and I think that song actually comes out of Key West because he mentions going into the Snake Pit, which I think was a bar down there. So, welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.